podcasting from Alexandria, Virginia, just a few miles from Washington, D.C., where we all hope doing what is right the first time is everyone's top priority. This is Software Quality Today, presented by Procellarex, a podcast about the trends and challenges of software quality testing and computerized system validation, and the people who are leading the way. Hear interviews with special guests and news from customers and vendors. I'm your host, Dori Gonzalez-Acevedo, and welcome to today's episode. Welcome to Software Quality Today, and I'm your host, Dori Gonzalez-Acevedo. I have the pleasure of bringing to the stage today Danielle Duran, Director of GXP Learning at Immune Therapeutics, a Nestle health science company, where she leads the learning governance and owner of the GXP training system. Her background in effective learning began in K-16 education and moved on to nonprofit and philanthropy education. She's worked as an adjunct faculty member at La Jolla Marymount and Temple University. Today, together, we explore some of her favorite current topics, some of which are like leveraging effective learning to support quality culture, shifting towards effectiveness measures of training, and the big picture of why it's so essential now more than ever to move towards a people-centric learning model as part of your core business operations. This is definitely only the beginning, and I'm sure Danielle will be back on the podcast soon. So without further ado, welcome Danielle. Well, welcome to another episode of Software Quality Today. Hi, Danielle. How are you today?
I'm great. Thanks, Dori, for having me.
So I am so excited about today because we've met over the course of this last year at a couple different events, but this last event in December, we got to know each other even more. And I'm so excited about our new collaboration and friendship and all of that stuff.
Love it. I'm so excited.
So before we get started, I would love for you to tell everyone about your journey to where you are today as a director of GXP Learning.
Sure. So I took a route through learning. That's how I got where I am right now. It started my very first role out of college was teaching math and science and medieval modern world history. To seventh graders in South LA. And I was feeling pretty passionate by the end of my first couple of years about teaching math and turning preteens into math nerds. That was a mission that I had. But given how things worked in large public school systems at the time, I was bumped from my position and was being pushed into a role to teach more history, which I was less passionate about. And that caused me to reevaluate what I wanted to be doing. I ended up doing some recruitment for the teaching program that I was in to make sure that my students were going to have really great math teachers. But working in recruitment taught me that I wanted longer term relationships where I could coach and support the growth and success of others. And so I ended up in a role where I was coaching and supporting new teachers. And that led me to a place of managing sets of those coaches. And then I moved into other roles related to teaching and education for a while, including some education technology. And then I ended up in philanthropy. So I've done every single side of education you could do. And in that philanthropy role, I started doing a lot more evaluation of effectiveness of programs and of education programs and what are models of doing that and working. Another role that I had was working with the state on creating an assessment for the California Community College System. And so I got to work with psychometricians, and that's when I first started learning about validation, testing validation. And that was very interested in that. So these little bits of things along the way. And I did study science in college. I spent a lot of time in labs, and I think there's always a little bit of something missing in my heart for that science heartness in me. That, I don't know. I'm lost for words for the right thing there. But a role opened up at a biotech company closer to where I lived, and I just jumped at the opportunity. It was in corporate training and in the compliance area. So it was great because I got to learn everything about GXP from the highest level. I got to understand everything about compliance and what that means. I got to work with a lot of auditors, and that gave me a really good view into what I was doing. That department was ultimately eliminated, and I moved into technical operations, where I was overseeing one of our manufacturing sites, and not site, one of the manufacturing groups within this larger site. There were several. So I worked in gene therapy for a little while supporting that group, and then ultimately led our site training team and was working on global initiatives and really wanted to just continue having a larger global impact. So that's, and then I found the role that I'm in right now, where I get to oversee the governance of training, the training system writ large for the enterprise, and I am responsible for all of the regulated training.
So part of your story is very common of some of the women that I've also interviewed this past year, right? Is that we've had these kind of very divergent, mazes of careers, right?
Oh, yeah. It was not a straight line.
And you're a mom and all this other stuff. All those
Oh, yeah.
Other hats
and I had a baby during that time. Yep.
Yeah. So what about that, having that diversity of experience gives you the opportunity to do what you do today?
So in my experience so far, when it comes to my colleagues in the regulated side of training, I haven't really come across that many that have a full background in education and really understanding at a deep level how learning really works, what the neurobiology of that is, and what just the vast tools that are available for effective learning. And a lot of times, I think folks in my type of a role will come from IT or will come from quality. And then the folks in L&D that are on the commercial side, often they're really successful sales trainers, and it's a step on the way to management. But I think the advantage that I have is really understanding what effective learning is and how it connects to culture and how important the culture part is when it comes to learning. And the neuro stuff matters because it's how available your mind even is in order to learn. And that's not something that we think about or talk about a whole lot.
Absolutely. 100% agree. And one of the things in what you're saying strikes me a real issue over the years that I've seen is that the effectiveness piece, right? Whether we're talking mm-hmm. about effectiveness of Kappa implementation or effectiveness mm-hmm. of learning, there's been a huge gap within the industry. And one of the things often has been said, oh, we'll just do a read and learn and understand, right? Mm-hmm. And I know that bugs you out like really, really bad. And it bugs me out too. But so can you say more about that and why sure. this effectiveness piece is really, really critical?
I also think that this is something that the health authorities are paying attention to even more. So it's even more important that we have the conversation. I think in the past, it was acceptable that a training activity being complete meant that it was effective. But especially within what you're referring to, where training, the word training is equated to an attestation of understanding without any measure of, well, what's our evidence? And I find that so interesting for this field where everything is evidence-based, right? You're not going to take a product from, across the phases without really strong evidence that it's got really high efficacy. So, how come we're not practicing the same thing when it comes to our learning? And it's expensive. Conducting mm-hmm. training activities, yeah. it takes a lot of time, even if it's just reading SOPs, which is not training, it's just right. reading. But yeah. that's, it takes time. And people only have so much bandwidth, so much mental RAM, you could say, in right. order to process new information. And then if they're not going to put it to use, so if you don't have an actual training activity, and they're putting it to use, applying it, they're really not going to learn it effectively. I mean, right. yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's a big issue that we've seen in quality management programs or not such great quality management programs, right? I think we've also historically have been led to think that if we do the checklist and that we provide the checklist to the auditors or to the regulators, then that if as long as that checklist is done and all those signatures are there as that attestation is there, then
right.
Then we're good and we can walk away and we've done our job, right? And that's not necessarily the case, right? I think there's plenty of examples out there where, we've put as a Kappa item, right, that it's due to training, right? Human error,
Retrain.
Human error, mm-hmm. retrain. And how many times do we do that, right, over and over again and simplify it in that sort of way, but yet get to an end result where something is reproducible and effective and learned from and added value to, right? All of those things. And then the other part of that is walking the walk, like saying, oh, go do this training, but actually invest in the dollars associated to that. So I know you have some thoughts around how, where is learning in the scale of organizational hierarchy?
Yeah. Well, I think the most critical thing that anyone can do, and a lot of what I recommend is, I'll say like quote free, in that it's really just how are you leveraging the resources you already have, primarily people and their time. And I remember I found a quote some time ago that I wish I knew who said it. Maybe someone, one of the listeners will know, but it's something like, if you don't have time to do it right now, when will you have time to fix it? And I know there's stats somewhere that I've read that, talk about the cost of quality and the cost of preventing an error as opposed to fixing an error. There's something I talked to my 7-year-old daughter about literally like 2 days ago. I was like, okay, but is it easier if we prevent this giant mess from happening? Or what's the investment? How am I going to, how much is
right.
time
and I think,
take?
So you talking to your 7-year-old around that, I think most folks know that organically at some level that is the right thing to do.
But we don't do it. So So I'll start even with this idea of a human error in Kappa. So there's a human error. To what extent are we holding ourselves accountable to spending the time to get to a really good specific root cause? And if that root cause really is, well, I didn't understand what I was supposed to do, that's different than I didn't follow the directions, right? Like those are two very different conversations. Right. I could see retrain, sure, if you just didn't do it, then like, okay, we need to have a little heavier hand. But if I didn't know what to do, that's very different. But if your Kappa is retrained the exact same way you did the first time, then what's your confidence that it's going to work the second time if it didn't work the first time? And so I think a lot of times in our field, things are so fast and no one wants to slow down because we're all under so much pressure, right?
I would argue that's a lot of many verticals. It's not just like sciences, right?
Sure.
I mean, I think that's... also kind of the awakening out of COVID, right?
Right.
That I think now we can globally and universally say we don't have enough brain mental load to go around.
Oh yeah. Not for all the things that we're demanding of everybody. So, and that's where, so using that as the little kernel example, but thinking bigger of if a manager says, my people, what does it look like to be qualified? What does it mean? And then take that time to really define, what does it mean to be qualified that I feel really confident in my people being successful later? And then if they think that someone needs some additional training, then how is the manager going to know that that training worked? How do they know that it was a good investment in time? What should they be looking for later to see, that training did have an impact? And I think that's where I really wish, one of the things I wish I saw more of was managers being super engaged in what's in my people's curriculum. Mm-hmm. What do they need to do, whether it's SOPs or on-the-job trainings or, some other type of e-learning? is that really the thing that's going to get me, my people, to where they need to go?
Well, so let's pause there for a moment, because do we think that the managers at those levels actually have the skills that they need in order even to make those assessments?
Right. Well, that's a very good question. And I'm not sure they're, I don't know. I think a lot of times, not necessarily, but I don't know if they're ever taught what that looks like. Right. Mm-hmm. We oftentimes, especially the mid-level managers, they're not, that's not something they've ever even seen. So how are they supposed to know how to do that?
That's right.
And then there's the, you know, very common leadership training, right, that people might get, but that's not teaching you this very technical skill of how am I defining qualification for my people? How will I know what a gap is in their performance and how to match that with the right? I think I've just seen some really like heartbreaking examples of quote mm-hmm. performance management when someone mm-hmm. isn't performing, but the manager doesn't know how to coach them into higher performance. Because it's not straightforward, and it's not simple, and sometimes it takes a lot of that.
It is so complicated. I mean, I know even with my teenager, right? Like, there's so many complexities to learning styles. Mm-hmm. Myself, dyslexic, and it is not something that I really understood until much, much later on in my life. Now that I know that, I know some things that I can do in order to help mitigate that, right? But there's a whole spectrum out here for how one can consume information in general.
Right. And the most important thing to remember is there's I'm blanking on the term. I just saw a LinkedIn post about it. There's types of intelligences, like the seven, mm-hmm. I think it's Howard Gardner, like types of intelligences. And then there's, I think what we grew up being told was learning styles, right? Visual, auditory, tactile, right. Whatever. But what the research has shown is that learning styles isn't a thing. It's the preferences are real. But what matters for effectiveness, and again, I'm coming back to effectiveness, is that you're tying the right style to the content. So mm-hmm. it's kind of like, are you trying to teach how to identify birdsong or, I guess in our area, visual inspection of something in QC, but are you teaching it with visuals? Like, you have to see it in visual. You can't just describe it. Or do you need to mm-hmm. see the actual thing with examples as opposed to pictures? Right. So just being really clear with, again, the most important thing is know what you're trying to accomplish so that you can plan to that. And it takes a lot of time. It's hard work. That's mm-hmm. very like heavy cognitive load of, do I really know what I want to get out of this program? And that's my argument against buying off-the-shelf training programs, because it's very easy to want to outsource that mental load and say, oh no, someone already made this thing. Someone already made these e-learnings. I just have to give them to my people and make them watch these videos, as opposed to, well, what do my people specifically need in order to be successful? These e-learnings could be a tool, but what questions am I going to ask about it? Or what's the conversation and how are we going to apply this new information so that they can put it to use? Otherwise, just watch TED Talks or I don't know, what are we doing?
Yeah. And there's so much content out there too. It's like, so then what do you even choose? Right. Because at that point it's just a commodity and not something specific to your organization, to the actual use case that you need, to the pain
exactly.
points that you have, to
exactly.
the people that you have, the combination of full-time employees versus contractors, right?
That's tricky with employment law in some states.
Yeah. It's a big, big deal, right? So, and we're in an industry that does do a lot of contracting, right? And so then whose responsibility it is to train, right? Am I paying those contractors my time in order to train them, or should they be coming in trained as some base level, understanding? And so whose responsibility is that?
Right. And how often are we evaluating? Like, do we really know? Because they say, they're saying that they know these things, but do I check, or how do I check, or what's effective to check?
It's really hard. I mean, I struggle even internally here as we were building out our team here at Persolex, was like to really understand everyone's needs, right? We're small enough that we can do that, right? But yet how to continuously monitor and engage with them in order to have them grow, right? So what are the gaps? I am not a learning specialist. Right.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and so what I approach it from a scientific perspective, and it's trial and error, right? It's, you know, put something in place. Does it work? Does it not work? As an effectiveness check, right?
Yeah. You know? But that's great that you're checking, did it work? That's the most important thing. That's the question I got asked during an inspection of the MHRA. You know, how do you know that worked? How did you know that aseptic technique training worked? And, you know, having someone pass a quiz that requires them to pass it at 100%, is that really evidence that it did work? And this is, I was on a panel, or I hosted a panel in June where I had a health authority member share, what are you really looking for when it comes to effectiveness of training? And his response included a lot of things like, well, there's certain things that people think that we want, but that's all the floor. Like, mm-hmm. Yes, you should have strong training metrics of completing training on time, quote, training, right? SOP training. But that's just a standard expectation. That should just happen. What really matters is your QMS. What are your deviations looking like? Mm-hmm. What do your kappas look like? How effective are your kappas? And the thing that he really spent most time on was collaboration, which I was mm-hmm. not expecting. And he talked a lot about documentation of procedures. And is everybody in the room that needs to be in the room when designing that procedure? Are the people who are executing there to mm-hmm. make sure that it's going to work? And then do you test it before you make it effective? Do you go and make sure it works? And then is there improvement over time? And that's not something that we talk about ever when it comes to training effectiveness.
It's very interesting. So I don't know, 15 years ago when we did PQs or performance qualifications, right, for CSV, when we were still kind of doing that terminology for CSV, part of the methodology that I had rolled out at that time was actually executing an SOP, right, as evidence that the system was performing as intended, because if the SOP that's written for that system is not able to execute and get the result that you want, then something's amiss, right?
Right.
I've seen that go away. Like that doesn't happen anymore. And I wonder about that, because I think that back to your earlier point around how much time and effort are we spending on these activities? You know, we do a lot of stuff around validation and getting things to a state of quote unquote, you know, validated, but the ongoing maintenance and the operation is where all this stuff really lives, right?
Right, right.
How is it working? What's not working? Even though they're systems and we programmatically design them for some things, still there's a huge amount of input, human input that's required. Regardless of what we're talking about, machine learning or automation too, right? Because that's a whole other thing.
There's still humans involved, which means there's still going to be, you know, room for error.
Yeah. Yeah. So what would your ideal kind of, you know, in a 40-hour week, what would you want employees to be spending their time on? I'm curious to hear what you think.
How people should spend time. I think, if I had a wish list, right, if money wasn't an object and people could, I would love that from the, what is it? There's the common 80-20-10 model or 70-20-10 model of the most of your learning comes from doing your job. And I had a manager in, geez, when was it? 2007, maybe, who... 2008, maybe, who told me the best professional development you can do is your job well. And I thought, I think I didn't want to hear that, because I think I wanted to do, you know, conferences and courses and special projects. But I'll never forget that, of her telling me you need to do your job well. And I think about that a lot because there's a lot of parts of my job that I'm still, you know, things change so much. I have my scope changes, things are new. I have to do a new type of system and I could learn, I could keep learning even if I'm doing only my job, right? Mm-hmm. So I think the piece that's missing is the reflection. So if you know, people typically, I think they say the effective like use of people, it's you have 70% of your time that you're actually getting anything done. The rest is who knows what. So out of that 70%, if you're doing your job for 70% of that time, then you still need to build in, I'd say, at least a half an hour once or twice a week for reflection. Like, what am I doing that's working? Who did I talk to that said something really insightful? Where did I read something that I want to, you know, apply? And then the 2010, that's the, you know, coaching mentoring is 20, and then 10 is the actual learning. I don't know. I honestly don't know if I know anybody who actually spends 10% of their time on learning outside of work. I don't think I know anybody, not even me.
I think it's hard. I think it's something we don't prioritize, right? And part of what I also hear you saying, though, is also but a different approach to how you do work. So one of the things I just heard in what you were describing, Danielle, was mm-hmm. that how you approach work, which is actually very similar to me and maybe part of why we feel so akin, is in it is learning, right?
Yeah.
And doing it all in, right? Like fully consumed and in the flow, if you will, right? Like really asking all those questions, you know, inside and out, deconstructing, reconstructing is all part of the process of which I do my day-to-day job.
Right, right. And asking those questions and figuring out, well, who else do I need to talk to? Or who else might know something about this? Or who's doing this better? Or I don't know what went wrong there, but I need to, you know, it's a lot of asking questions to understand, right? And I think that without having a really strong growth mindset, that can be really hard and it can feel very threatening and scary.
And you also need an organization that supports that.
Yeah.
Right. Because mm-hmm. if you don't have an organization that supports curiosity and a growth mindset, what are you left with? You're left with, you have to make sure you get these 10 widgets done before the end of the week because that's your job and that's your task. And we really don't care about much anything else other than the task, right?
Right, right. And well, there's the aspect of the making the widgets where if something goes wrong with the widget, if there's not a strong learning culture, then that deviation on the widget isn't going to be escalated as quickly or as thoroughly. Right. Mm-hmm. So having that learning mindset, having that learning culture is critical for a strong QMS mm-hmm. because you have to make people comfortable with mistakes and learning from those mistakes. And then the last thing you want to do is have five different people make the same widget mistake. Then mm-hmm. how much waste is that? Right. That's wasting time, right. Wasting product, wasting raw materials, you know, putting in danger, getting product to patient or whatever product to whoever uses a widget. Right. And that's where that bigger picture lessons learned comes in. And so even if we don't have time to spend 20% of your time with a coach or a mentor, I mean, that's really what some of your manager interactions should be like. Are you getting enough coaching from your manager? Are you presenting enough information so that you can be coached? Right. And then are we really preparing our managers to be effective coaches?
Probably not enough.
I think plenty of companies that are successful have made statements about, you know, it's your competitive advantage is how quickly you can learn.
Yep.
Right.
And adapt and pivot and all of that. Right. And in order to do that, it's a lot of the things that we're talking about, right? The learning mm-hmm. mindset, the curiosity is, you know, the constant questioning. I also think that questioning in some cultures is not accepted. Right. And so to add to the complexity of this entire conversation, right, is to put in a diverse workforce or hoping that most folks are striving for a diverse workforce, but that does require even more question, more understanding on everyone's part.
And sometimes you can't wait for people to ask a question. You need to be inviting, right? Invite mm-hmm. How do you create a culture of inviting that kind of feedback, whether it's on behavior and performance or on a product or on a process, right? Like and making sure that we have lots of those diverse experiences so that we get the best in the end as possible.
Yeah. So in your, you know, kind of exploration, and I know you've done some talking and as well as at some major conferences. So you have you hear a lot of things. And what are some of the things that are pitfalls or the gotchas that folks could quickly just nip in the bud and stop doing in their learning program or do better?
I think some things, I'll share one pet peeve, which I think drives people crazy, even if they don't realize it. And that's gathering data that you don't use or having data that you could use, but you don't do anything. Like an example could be a lot of people might have quizzes, right? Or some type of knowledge assessment connected to reading an SOP or reading a PowerPoint, whatever it would be. But how often are you leveraging that data to improve an SOP? Like, geez, this question has a 30% pass rate on the first time. Maybe we should clarify it. If you're using mm-hmm. your SOPs as training materials, which they're not usually written to be a training material, then right. then you have to pay attention to the performance of it as a training material. Mm-hmm. That would be one thing.
Well, that actually goes right back to your whole the psychometrics, right? Of a lot of stuff, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, in a well defined training program, learning management program, right? All of those metrics are part of the process of doing all of that, right? Which yeah. is fascinating to me because there's a lot of validation. Talk about validation. There's a lot of validation that goes into a lot of that stuff.
There is massive amounts, like massive, massive projects with like millions and millions of people, right? As data points with years and years of data over time. But I think the point that you just made is that's the other thing that can be a quick fix is, did you clearly define your objectives? Is your training program set up in a way that it's to accomplish tasks, or is it set up in a way to build knowledge or skill? And how clearly have you defined those requirements for qualification so that you can even track that? Because if you haven't defined it, then you can't gather data to show that it's working or not working.
Yeah. I think, again, given that we have younger kids, right? What I've been trying to instill is this, you know, constant learner, right? Mm-hmm. And learning yeah. how to learn for mm-hmm. themselves as they go through this process, and things that I would never have thought I would be saying to them, like, I really don't care about grades. I really don't care about this. I don't really care about this. Like, things that I held very true for me, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. I've thrown out the window, right? In service of curiosity and learning being the most important skill set that they can get now.
Yes. And the not being afraid to make mistakes. I had mm-hmm. no idea how much I would be battling this perfection pressure that mm-hmm. my daughter puts on herself. And, you know, just the amount, that's the whole idea of perfect is the enemy of good or something. Perfect mm-hmm. is the enemy of complete. Yep. I don't know. One of those tech companies has a thing. But that's, it's hard. And I think we all get kind of caught up in that also. And it's some of that analysis paralysis of, well, I want to do this thing for my training program, but it's this really huge, big thing. And so I just can't get started because it's so overwhelming where, you know, just pick one thing, pick one role, mm-hmm. or pick one set of SOPs on one critical, you know, set of procedures that you want to improve. Pick one piece of the QMS. Pick one department. You know, there's, you got to just start somewhere, and it'll feel so good when you're done. It will build some of that momentum to mm-hmm. get through some of the harder things.
Future thinking. What do you think the impact of AI and machine learning have on learning programs?
Oh, that's such a big question, and I have not been like up to date on all the time.
I feel bad about asking a bit, but no, I feel I think it's an important thing, right?
Because no, it is. I think so far, what I know has been a trend. I don't know about a trend, but I know people have gotten a lot more involved with AR and VR. So the augmented reality, virtual reality, when it comes to training, that's huge. And I'd say I had pretty strong opinions about it when I was working to support manufacturing, because my concern was that we were treating people like robots instead of leveraging the assets that they are people instead of robots. So it's fine to do augmented reality where, you know, you have some extra directions and it helps someone to do the task, but it's very easy to get cognitively lazy, honestly, is the best word, right? Like, we just want people to do this one thing and want them to do it perfectly every single time. But that's just not, you know, it might be more than, it might be a higher expectation than is reasonable. And if you want to, you know, I had a hard time really believing that the ROI on investing in AR, VR was going to come back. Like, is it really worth the investment? And what are you really trying to accomplish? And what are you really trying to automate out? Because I'm sure some of it is really good. But I think just like any tool that comes into the training and learning realm, especially on the GXP side, people get very excited about tools, but not necessarily building a program around the tool and really having clearly defined objectives and clearly defined KPIs for effectiveness. So if you're implementing and you have all that in place, then I'm super on board. But if you're implementing it because you think it'll make it easier, it won't. That's just not how it works. But when it comes to AI, I know a lot of like school systems, teachers are having to really reevaluate what they're expecting.
Yeah.
Just because how people are leveraging it.
Yeah, I think you're spot on around the expectation piece, right? I think that there's, and I can't even fathom, like, there's just so much to consume today, right? That's the other part, right? Like, that I worry about in just how much is possible. And then to your expectation point is what's necessary, right? And how to leverage the technology in service of doing better. And I don't know if we've, as an industry, at least in life sciences, if we're there yet, because we haven't really even been able to do like the basics yet, right? But I know it's wanted and it's coming, right? And
yeah, so, whether we like it or not, it's
right. And so I'm pondering that sort of thing, and not just in the learning space, but also in the manufacturing space, and because it's going to hit the manufacturing floor faster than ever before, and what are we that far behind, and how do we get up to speed?
Yeah, I think. Well, like anything else, like any of these tools, even like project management tools or, you know, tracking checklist tools, if it's not implemented mindfully with all these other, you know, objectives and how will you know it works and how are you going to train people to use it and what's okay and what's not, what are the guardrails, you're just adding more content. You're adding more stuff for people to do. And there's only so much that people can do. Just period. Yeah. You know, we max
right.
out.
Yeah.
So I remember reading something not too long ago about advice from someone saying it's a great tool in order to free you up to do the more complicated stuff. Like, yeah, let's right. I'm 100%. Let's automate all the little things.
Thanks. Yeah, yeah. Well, and that's any automation tool, right? I mean, that should be the expectation and the first low-hanging fruit, right? To get all of those tasks as automated as possible so that we can free up our brains to take on some higher level thinking. It's just a matter of what do you do? What's next and how does that evolve when your basic programs are not really hitting the marks in some regards, right? So we talked a little bit about like, you know, quality as an ROI, but like learning as an ROI is probably even harder to quantify, I suspect. I haven't tried. Have you had to do metrics around that? Oh, tell me.
So I think one of the trickiest parts when working with your cross-functional partners to define what those KPIs are going to look like is not getting caught up in, oh, it's too complex, we can't do it, because there's so many factors. So there's the most common, I'd say, way to measure ROI in learning is the Kirkpatrick model, where it's four levels. Level one is, did the people like it? And that's where you get smile sheets, or you get the survey at the end, you know, are you satisfied? And then level two is knowledge transfer. And that's where the quizzes come in. So do you have evidence to show that knowledge was transferred? Did the knowledge transfer part work? Mm-hmm. And then level three is behaviors. And this is where it starts getting tricky, but, and you have to define it on the front end. So you define, I'm going to do X training. And the behavior I want to change or the behavior I want to build is X. And so how will I identify it later? And that's hard. Is who's going to identify it? How will it be reported? How will you record it? Right. And is there different observers, and do you have to validate the different observers? And that's where in education, you'd use rubrics, and then you train people to rubrics and you norm, but that's just not something I've ever really seen done here. And I think because it's not commonly done, people want to say, well, you can't do it. Well, yeah, you can. That's how you grade AP essays, you know, or that's how you evaluate teachers. Is you have a rubric and you have people norm and you have standards at each level, and then you all rate until you all get the same scores. So behaviors is level three, and then level four is business results. So if you, like, let's say you're working on your deviation training program, deviations take a certain amount of time at the, you know, that's your baseline. You take a certain measure, there's so many errors and it's this many interactions or whatever it's going to be. And then you do your training program. You test for, did people like it? You do a knowledge check. Do they retain certain amounts of new things that they have to do differently? And then the behaviors, do they change their behaviors? Are they submitting more on time? Are they filling these things out more correctly? Are they, you know, what are the behaviors? And then business result. Well, before the training, deviation took on average, you know, 28 days or had this many errors or took this much time period, right? And then you calculate that into a cost. Each deviation costs $10,000. But then after the training, with the follow-up, net we're saving $3,000 per deviation because of this training. So there's the business result. But it takes a lot of time and it takes a lot of data. And I just wish I had more lovely green belt, black belt people to work with to help with all that. And that's where I really wish there was more collaboration between the operational excellence or, you know, continuous improvement teams and learning, because our work is so related. Mm-hmm. I think it's funny. Sometimes I remember a boss I had a while ago, we were doing, worked in a business operations group, and we were doing an exercise, a marketing exercise for our department. And one of the questions was, who's our greatest competitor? Like, we offer a service, learning, continuous improvement. We offer a service, who's our greatest competitor? And it was our customers, our greatest competitors, because they want to do it themselves, or they've always done it themselves. Oh, they're not used to having support. And so we're not involved in these conversations. And so that's the other advice I'd give to people is, you have experts out there probably somewhere, you know, go to your learning person and partner, and you don't have to. I don't know why people don't. That would be a root cause I'd like to explore, is why when people don't reach out to their learning departments, Why not?
Well, but we see it with quality in IT too, or you know, quality in business. You know, like it's reaching across the aisle. It's having shared conversations. It's having nuanced mm-hmm. conversations. It's, you know, it's really
for having me, the time to do it.
Having the time to do it, knowing who to do it with, right? Who yep. you know, and also, you know, really breaking down the notion that your lane is your lane, and we're all connected, right? And and yep. really understanding that. And one of the things that I love about some of the good programs that I've seen is really like an understanding from a quality perspective how we're all involved, right? Like it's yeah. it's so incredibly important to have that connection be illustrated, be demonstrated within a whole organization. And part of that is the whole learning foundation from beginning to end. It's just like the quality, like, so quality and learning should not be separate from, it's kind of, you know, it's all part of the same thing.
Yeah. We're all, it's all an organism, right? That's the systems thinking, like Peter's saying,
yeah, absolutely.
System
yeah,
thinking. Yeah. And I don't know how much, again, this is to me, I would love to have a systems thinking program that, mm-hmm. you know, that people understand you have to consider all these other areas. And if right. you touch it up here, then downstream, what happens? No. Just like data. Like,
and it moves, right? So, and it moves and shifts. So as you put into that system, you know, it's entropy, extropy, right? Like as you move in, it contracts and moves here, and then it moves and shifts again. And it has to be that continuous look all the time, right? Of where the needs mm-hmm. and what in service of what, and what are the in service of the need at the moment? Because today is different from 6 months, you know, in, you know, the past six
yeah,
months.
2 weeks. Yeah, I mean, like weeks at a time, six
right.
months.
Yeah, yeah. So mm-hmm. all of those things. So this is awesome, and I thank you. And I also don't think this is going to be our last podcast because we have lots to chat about.
There's
I think
a
this
lot
was a good,
here. Yeah,
I think this is a good prime, you know, prime start here. And I thank you. For your time today. I really appreciate that.
It's thank you for the conversation. And I'd really love to know what people want to talk about more. You know, what are people curious about? What do they wish they knew more about?
That's great. So we'll ask that question when we post this out, have folks comment on, and we'll even do a live Q&A next time. And we'll get
Oh,
right
I'd love that.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right, Danielle. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Jory.
Thanks for listening to Software Quality Today. If you like what you just heard, we hope you pass along our web address, procellarx.co, to your friends and colleagues, and please leave us a positive review on iTunes. Be sure to check out our previous podcasts and check us out on LinkedIn at ProcellarX. Join us next time for another edition of Software Quality Today.